Colorful Sinai and Patrick on Colorful Radio.
Welcome to the Voices of Windrush with me, Sinai Flary, and my co-host, Mr. Patrick Vernon. On today's show, we will be talking about art therapy and mental well-being in our community surrounding the Windrush scandal. Over to you, Patrick.
Great. So I've got Dr. Elaine Arnold, academic, former social worker, who has spent many years researching the whole issue around emotional attachment theory. Anthony Bryant, who I got to know as a result of the Windrush scandal, who survived the scandal and is here to tell his story.
Okay, fantastic. So should we start with you, Anthony? Could you tell us what exactly happened to you during the Windrush scandal?
All I can remember is that I'm sitting in my house. Well, to be honest, that's not the story. I wanted to visit my mum in Jamaica. She was ill. And decided to do my passports and realised that they said that I'm an alien because I've not been naturalised. And so we're talking about me not being naturalised. So my missus took up the thing and decided to do my application. They turned it down, and then, long story, put me in a detention centre saying that I'm a legal immigrant. But to be honest, it was hard because they broke me in that sense.
How long was you in the detention centre?
I was only in there for 3 weeks, but the reason I didn't know when I was coming out, and I didn't know. They lock you up, you don't know when you're coming out, and I was frightened thinking I was going back to Jamaica because that's what they was telling me. Because I had tickets for me and them, so when I phoned the missus, she was saying that they can't do that. I said, well, they done it because they tell me that the following Wednesday, because that was the second time after they locked me up, they tell me, so they give me a ticket to go to Jamaica.
How did that make you feel?
Well, I felt scared because I didn't know Jamaica, and I was terrified. Mm. I was literally terrified. Yeah. I'm talking about it now and I'm sweating up because I remember them times.
Yeah. What age did you come to the UK?
9 years old.
Okay.
I came when I was nine. I came 1965.
Okay.
Done primary school here, done secondary school here, got my national insurance number when I was 16. So, it was hard.
Mm-hmm. And it must have been equally as hard on your family as well.
Well, it was because my son then was saying to me that, Dad, because I haven't signed to go because I didn't know how I was going to come out the whatever way I could come out. So I signed to go back to Jamaica, and my son then phoned me and said, Dad, what are you doing? You're crazy. You don't even know Jamaica. You don't even know a road in Jamaica. You're talking about going back to Jamaica. But it was hard.
Mm.
It was terrible.
Yeah. And then how did you come out of the detention centre? Like, what happened?
Well, what happened is that the first detention centre I went to, they wrote up a whole heap of things on me, say I had a gun crime, I had the daughters, I was living in country. They didn't want to release me because if they released me, I would terrorize the people living in the district.
Mm.
You want to see what they wrote up on it. So when I realized that what they had on the phone wasn't me, because I sat in there for about nearly 2 weeks before I even know what they had on me. So when I realized that, this is what they wrote up wasn't me, and I went to the man, I said to the warden, I think there's two different person. The Friday they let me go.
Okay. So then if you had not said anything, I don't think this is about me, they'd
had me there and want to deport me to Jamaica.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, because they just write up a whole heap of paperwork on me and it wasn't me.
Yeah. And I mean, how are things now that you've gone back to your family and...
Everything is not back to normal, obviously, because we had, between me and my missus, we had big bills. It's a good thing that I had my job to go back to.
Okay.
But it's a bit better now because I could sleep a bit easier. I don't have to worry about people coming and breaking down the door, asking me if I got my estate. and all these things. I know I got my state.
Yeah, but you should have never, ever been questioned in the first place. That's what's really frustrating and upsetting.
That's the heart of the scandal. The heart of the scandal was that actually, when you arrived in Britain, you were British.
Yeah.
And then you were told a few years later that you weren't British.
That I wasn't British.
Yeah.
And that is so... Where do you go from there? Because you feel lost.
Yeah.
You are. Yeah. It broke me in there. It broke me. Because I've never been to prison.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd like to bring in Dr. Elaine Arnold. For our listeners, can you explain the work that you've been doing around emotional attachment theory, and there's this concept of being left behind. What does that mean in your research work? And maybe Anthony might want to reflect on that. But you want to just...
Mm. Yes. When the Windrush came, I was in Trinidad at the time when the Windrush passed through Trinidad. And to be honest, many of us were saying, what are these people doing getting on this boat?
Where are they going?
To go where they don't know, you know. We knew, of course, of the migration, but on the surface, you say, look, some are teachers, some are nurses. There was a singer, and she had just got on Radio Trinidad, and say, you think she will get on radio in England? Because we knew of discrimination. But nevertheless, people wanted to come. They said it was free. The country was free. They could come as citizens and all the rest of it. Because in 1948, the British law had said as long as you were born in any part of the empire, you were British. So there was not a problem, you know, adventure and all that. But I was interested, really, because I had been involved in an orphanage in Trinidad teaching. I was a teacher. And we said orphanage, but only about 25% of the children were orphans. It had been set up when Indians were brought from India after slavery to the Caribbean, and mainly in Trinidad and Guyana, where the Indians were taken. And these two philanthropists, one English and one Scottish, had built this orphanage in the country. And over 500 children were in this institution, because it was built on the pattern of an old English workhouse. And children were there from birth up to 16. And when I went to the orphanage, these small children would be trying to put their hands up. They wanted to be held. They wanted to be touched. They wanted to be cuddled. And I thought, you know, something is wrong. Because although I had trained as a teacher, attachment theory and Bowlby's theory, John Bowlby, the man who really made attachment theory popular, had not been taught. We were taught educational psychology, you know, with learning and all the rest of it, rather than emotional. And I thought something was wrong. So I made every effort to try to further my studies about it. I was young then, and you know, when you're young, you think you can change things.
Mm.
Now I'm old, I realize that you knock your head against a brick wall. And you may change a little at the micro level, but it's difficult to get through to the macro level. Nevertheless, you mustn't give up. So I finally was able to come to Britain with the aid of a United Nations scholarship, where United Nations were putting money into various underdeveloped countries. And there, I came to read Bowlby's theory. And the children he was describing, I thought, well, these are the children I left in Trinidad. So it isn't the color that make people behave the way they behave. It's the context and the circumstance, and it's human growth and development. If you are separated from somebody to whom you have made a bond, mm-hmm. you will behave in a certain way. You will protest by crying and trying to follow them. And when you find that that person isn't there, you will become in a state of despair. You're depressed. Children don't want to play. Sometimes they don't want to eat. Sometimes they regress. They go back to maybe wetting the bed and things like that, which a number of people didn't understand. Mm. Even the people caring for them in the orphanage didn't. And then the third form of behavior would be that they become attached. They don't want to relate to anybody. And when you try to relate to them, they were more interested in what you had to give them than you. So they'll say, what have you got in the bag? What you brought for me? Rather than wanting to relate. And then we found that one thing about people who have been taken away from the person who have nurtured them in those early days is that they find it difficult to make relationships mm. and to sustain them, to keep them. You find that they may come along and, oh, I'm your friend today, and by tomorrow they're not, because they don't trust. They don't trust you. They think that if they get too close to you, you're going to leave them, and they will be hurt again. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they stand off. Mm. But many people thought that when the children became that way, that they had come to terms with it, and they were good, and they were happy. Oh. But that then went on to be shown at school.
Yeah.
They would react to the teachers in the same way.
Yeah.
And they're interested in the task, even though they can't do it. And if the teacher gets too close, they tell her where to go, you know. Mm. And here in this country, the children will tell you to F off.
Oh. I think this is so interesting, because normally we don't hear information about the children who were left back in the Caribbean when their parents came over. We don't know how did they turn out? How did they cope with being separated from their families? Mm. How did their lives turn out? Did they go on to be successful?
They were just as bad as us. Because they were disrupt.
Yeah.
I was, because the main thing what's upsetting for me when I went back to Jamaica, everything, it was worse.
Yeah.
And it was 50 years on. The river was running, the Niger River was running, where I come from, it's dried up, dried as a bone. So it's not get better to me, it's got worse. Mm. And I come to England here and, yeah, mm. you think you're doing a better life, but you ain't it better life.
Mm.
It's not a better life.
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
So Elaine, from your, you've written many books and research papers, and you inspired lots of students and academics in the UK. I think you're a really unsung hero. I mean, I really admire you. No, seriously. And so from your perspective, Ryan, when you heard about the Windrush scandal, what was your initial thoughts? And what's your reflection in terms of the work that you've been doing for many years? Actually, in many ways, you've been talking about the same issue. The difference now was that the government actually said it in black and white, mm. we don't think you're British anymore. And therefore, you know, it's like a double whammy, isn't it?
Mm. Mm. When I thought, oh my goodness, why haven't these people learnt anything over these years? First of all, the administration and the whole system was very badly serviced about losing people's papers and things like that is unforgivable. I remember when I was at Sussex University doing my MPhil, because I had gone back to Trinidad after coming here first, gone back to Trinidad to see if I could change that system there about sending children to orphanages. Mm-hmm. And then that wasn't happening. And the mothers, some of the mothers were even leaving the children in the orphanage to come. Mm-hmm. And the psychology taught us that just as children need their mothers, mothers also need their children. Mm. So I began wondering what was happening to these mothers who were here and left their children behind. So I thought I would come and study those mothers. And that's another story. Because they then began to have children here, because remember, they were young, of childbearing age. They came, they met their partners. And what happened? They were separated from these children and sent to residential nurseries out in the counties and all the rest of it. But that is another story. So I was at Sussex doing this study now, doing my MPhil. I had 2 years, and suddenly a letter came to the house owner, to ask whether there was someone in the house who was illegally there. I had two years permit to study, admitted to the university. And in the middle of the first year, they were inquiring whether I was there illegally. So I went up to Wesley House and I said, look here, I have 2 years study leave granted by the government of Trinidad and Tobago, processed by the High Commission in Trinidad, stamped 2 years. So what are you asking about? I'm not here illegally. I am here as a student. And at the end of the 2 years, I'm going back to Trinidad. And everybody went red, purple, all sorts of colors, that they had made this mistake. And that was that. So the inefficiency in dealing with people who came on the Windrush, who came on their children's passport, was unbelievable and unforgivable, really. And, all right, the Prime Minister apologized and people resigned and all that sort of thing, but the problem has not been solved.
No.
And we still need to educate those people about what happened, and that they had, these children had a right, who are now adults, have a right to be here.
Mm-hmm. Is that something you agree with, Anthony?
Yeah, because I was saying I had a right. When you told me that I need to pay to be, I was saying why? Mm. And I was, when I came, I was British when I came. And that was one of the things I was saying, but they were saying, just go with the norm and pay and do what we need to do. Mm. And I was saying, no.
Yeah.
You know, I'm British before. Why do I have to pay to be British again? And even my friends, even my family was saying, no.
Yeah.
You know, because they were just do the easy thing. Just do what, because
just do what they're asking for, yeah.
And I was one of them where I was fighting it all along.
Yeah. Where's things at now with you? Have you, I know things will never ever like be the same, like, but do you feel, like you said, you can sleep now, you're a bit more relaxed. Have you put in a compensation claim for everything you've been through?
I have put in a compensation claim. Mm-hmm. I'm in the process of doing it. I've still got finalized last.
Good.
I need help to do it because I don't feel confident in
doing
that by myself.
Okay.
It seems simple, but it's not.
It's very complicated.
I find it very difficult to do. So I find it very difficult. I can look help to. Help to do it with me.
Okay. And in terms of traveling, have you any plans to go and visit Jamaica?
Why, I went over there and I fall in love again with it. I fall in love with all the Caribbean people. I fall in love with black people again.
Yeah.
I went over there. It was great.
Mm-hmm.
It was great. The place where I come from, I'd say, is a bit run down.
Where is that? Don't say it's run down. What part of Jamaica is it?
I come from St. Anne's. It's where I cast Mount Moriah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's nice and green because it's a farming place.
Yeah. Really, St. Anne is very green.
Yeah.
Very, very green. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was just nice.
Oh, just good. Nice. Mm. It's nice to see you smile again.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember first meeting you about 13, 14 months ago when.
It was nice.
And there was lots of meetings and lots of stuff. And there was even then. You know, there was Sarah, and everyone else that was together, and you know, so, and it just felt like people didn't know what was going to happen. You know what I mean?
Nobody ever knew what was happening, but I'm sure it was when the people from your country, who I was really proud of, because they were kind of pushing it, the Windrush thing, and I saw most of the because he was there, the 12 people who came over.
Yes.
Prime Minister didn't want to see.
Yeah.
But it started from then.
Mm-hmm.
So it all started from then. But and Amelia, gentleman, if she wasn't, because when I got in touch with her, everything started moving.
So, yeah.
I couldn't get no answer. But I went to immigration. They didn't want to talk to me. I couldn't get no interview from them. But as soon as Emile, a gentleman, wrote the story, I started getting everybody wanted.
I think everyone's got the same story that
all
of a sudden the Home Office was on the spotlight.
Yeah, everybody
because you were like your media attention, so they had to do something.
But even the great David, I went to a meeting one night. All of the black people that was in power in there, none of them didn't help none of us. But as soon as it broke, he was there talking about it. He lay down with dogs and get fleas and all that.
Yeah.
I know David Lammy good. On the site where I used to go, I couldn't approach him. He didn't want to talk to none of us.
Yeah.
I think there's a different kind of pressure that politicians and people in the public feel. When there's a media outpouring of an issue, they automatically feel like really pressurized to talk about it and address it. So that's why it's important for us to keep the conversation going because even now there's people in our community who still are suffering.
Yes. Big time. Even more than me. If I didn't have the support I had with my missus, to be honest, I'd have been
Your missus is fantastic.
Listen.
She's fantastic.
I can't talk enough about that.
Yeah.
I can't give that woman enough praise.
I think you've defined something because, you know, going back to Lane's, your work, it's about the whole stuff around attachment theory. If you've been left behind, you come over here. Actually, is that a right expression? Is it derogatory to use the word left behind? Because you were left behind, you came over, but you've got a new life, you've got your wife and family. But do you think that's quite derogatory to say left behind? It's almost like it's a... Is that a stigma thing or not? Or is that part of parlance or...?
Well, some of the kids don't feel left behind.
Yeah.
Yeah, some of them do feel
some,
left behind.
Yeah.
And some of them feel hurt, the kids then where they meet here.
Yeah.
Them brothers and sisters, because they can't get with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because no one prepared them. You know, there was no preparation.
Given to this auntie.
Yes.
And that's it. You didn't have no say.
That's right.
You just have to just start... Because... When my mom left me in Jamaica, she had to come back for me at the first house she left me, because when she came, peer scratches out of my face.
Yeah.
With my cousins, she used to be beating me up.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So, you get them things.
Yes. Some families, the grandparents, were very good. But others, everybody didn't have a good experience, because... Sometimes they were left with other members of the extended families or godmothers or a friend or somebody. And sometimes so many children were left together. In doing my research, one woman told me she was one of 12 left with her grandmother. And she said that she didn't have enough love to go around.
Yeah.
No, you don't.
You know? So,
and I think that would bring a sense of resentment,
of course,
in those children.
Because the ones in which she being abandoned. Does give love to, the ones who don't get it, target that one who does get love.
Yeah.
It's an unfair thing, but that's what happened in real life.
Yeah.
You will get that.
Yeah,
but many of the women felt that this was part of the pattern of bringing up children, because some of them lived in a compound where their mothers were looking after their children whilst they went to work, maybe in the country and so on. But the difference about that. If they were working in the country, they would come home and the children would know, this is mom, this is grandmom. But many of those children felt that those grandmothers were their real mothers.
Mothers, yeah.
And when they came here, one woman told me she was met at the airport. Her mother only knew her because she had sent her a red coat. So she was looking for somebody in a red coat.
Yeah.
We'll be tied if six mothers had sent red coats, because they wouldn't know who was who.
Yeah.
And this mother made an attempt. And this child, she said she was pulling backwards and wondering, this strange woman is coming towards me. I don't know her. Mm-hmm. So you can understand the hurt on both sides. The mother hurt that the child doesn't know her, and the child hurting for the grandmother who had nurtured her. Mm-hmm. It's the nurturing.
I went through the same thing. Yeah. Because I didn't know my mom when I came.
That's right.
Mm. She was saying that she's my mom, and I said, no, her mom, who I left over there,
that's right,
is my mom.
Yeah, fascinating, absolutely fascinating. We'll have to touch on this again.
I think this is the start of a conversation, because I think it feeds into the wider issue around mental health and well-being, and the whole stuff around why we're so overrepresented in the system,
and that's why I think we
lack of love and people attracted to wrong reasons for, you know.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's a big topic that nobody knows all about it.
Exactly.
We have to go on learning. And a 65-year-old person came to me a few months ago.
And still having issues based on that.
Not dealt with. You can't leave things, them trauma things there, them big things there, and not deal with them. They will come back and bite you.
Yeah. I feel like you both have touched on something very important, and it's something that we will have to continue discussing at a later date as we have run out of time. But it has been so great speaking to you both. Thank you so much for coming into the Voices of Windrush. It's been an honor speaking to you both.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Colorful.
Sinai and Patrick. Colorful Radio.
Joining us in the studio right now is Damien Gabriel, who is a third generation Windrush survivor. How are you doing?
Not too bad.
Okay.
Hi, Damien. It's great to see you again. And could you just tell us, we met some time ago, and is there any news or any developments in your situation in terms of your status here in the UK?
It's kind of been going quite well, I should say. I've been getting quite a lot of help in my situation. I think kind of the more you speak up, the more people hears and people want to help, you know?
Yeah.
So I think, like, because I kind of been speaking up out about it, I've been getting quite a lot of help about the whole situation, so which was quite good. Yeah.
That's good.
Kind of my expectation was here, but now it's
that's great. I know Movement for Justice are helping you. And were you at the some rally some time ago in Parliament? Were you for that? Did you meet any MPs?
We didn't meet our MP at the time, but we met our MP afterwards. Which was better, because it was kind of better to have a close speak, like, you know, just a one to one. And at the rally, we met quite a lot of different people, spoke to so many different MPs as well at the same time. And it was quite good, like, sharing opinions about it and kind of letting them know about, like, p- people that are out there suffering in silence, you know, without no one knowing, and people are even suffering mental health, like how I am suffering with it, you know.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like good, like raising the awareness about it as well. So I think that kind of change helped me to get more help into my situation as well.
Okay.
So
that's good that you feel more empowered. And
yeah, definitely.
And what we're exploring is about the impact of the scandal on people's mental well-being. And you touched on this very briefly last time, but you want to kind of elaborate more in terms of when you realised that your situation wasn't what it was. What can you explain what you felt and what and how that felt for you, and in terms of your mental well-being, and what support did you have, and etc.
Well,
if any.
Well, it was quite difficult because you know, going into the NHS, especially as a black person as well, suffering with mental health, it's kind of like quite tricky in that kind of way, because automatically I feel like there is a barrier and there is a stigma about black people already. But I feel like because in my head I kind of always had, I need justice for myself, for my own human rights, because I try to not to be too into like you're white and I'm black, you know. Because I feel like when you start doing that, you build up a barrier and a differences already. So I kind of more trying to kind of focus on you're a person just like me, and I'm trying to get the best help as possible. So how can you help me, you know? So because I think I was doing that, it kind of helped me to kind of got a little bit more help than usual. So than someone that is probably would have come in and be kind of thinking about, yeah, I'm not going to get treatment. I'm gonna get treated differently anyway, you know, because of my colour.
Were you given a diagnosis when you contacted the NHS?
Yes, the first time it was with psychosis. Yeah, I was diagnosed with psychosis the first time.
Yeah.
Was
it as a result of your status?
Yes.
Psychosis. That's
Psychosis
is a pretty heavy label.
Yeah.
I mean, because psychosis means that you've either had psychotic episodes, or you are likely to have psychotic episodes, and that could range from a whole range of situations, which is quite a heavy label to have, as opposed to depression or
it is.
And do you feel that was justified?
Yes, it was.
Yeah?
Because I was waiting for my papers.
Yeah.
Quite a long time.
Yes.
The build up.
It was just pressure
and feeling like you're not part of.
Yeah.
Like, who are you?
Yeah.
You know, because that question always comes up, because you kind of look at people that are same age with you, or people, your friends
doing stuff they're doing. Yeah. Yeah, and you
having their family, and then you're the only person that's just stuck in limbo, can't do nothing with your life.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like that was the main part of what caused my illness, because it kind of made me feel trapped. I didn't know what to do with myself. You know.
Did you volunteer to go to services, or were you sectioned?
I didn't got section, which was very good, because I think part of me was still there, you know.
Yes.
Part of me was always there.
Mm.
So in that kind of way, it kind of made me felt more compromised of getting help, because I had to realize I was ill. It's only when I realized something was wrong. Mm. That's kind of why I said part of me was still there, because when I realized something was wrong and I needed help.
And that's so brave of you, because a lot of us probably would have got bogged down and think, okay, I can't be bothered to go. This is how I feel.
Yeah.
That's so brave to actually say, nope, something's not right. I'm going to go and seek help.
Yeah.
So how are things now with you, like mentally?
Well, mentally is way better mentally. I'm still getting like symptoms, but because I've learned mindfulness exercises, which I was just talking to Lord Sunside about it. I've learned like how to kind of treat my own voices in my head, you know, because I realize it's my own voices, it's nobody else's. I've kind of learned how to kind of quiet them down and how to challenge it, because I realize the voices are coming from my emotions. So if I'm in an angry state, then I'll have angry voices.
Yeah.
If I'm in a lovely state, then I'll have lovely voices. Yeah. If I'm in a sad state, I'll have sad voices. Mm-hmm. So it's depending on how I'm feeling.
Yeah.
So because I've got the awareness of that, so it kind of made me challenge my voices when it comes to me now, because I realize if I'm getting a voice that's angry, I'm like, okay, why do I feel angry now? I know there's an angry person inside of me now. Mm. So I challenge that person. Why are you angry, you know? Mm. What makes you feel angry? And because I'm doing that, then it brings me back to something probably happened to me. And oh, that's why I'm angry, you know?
You can actually assess
it.
So I could actually
assess it in my head and kind of go back to probably someone just stepping on my shoes, you know? Mm. Yeah. I didn't say anything, but at the time, you know? But when I got home, I got angry about it, thinking, like, why didn't I say anything, you know?
Yeah. So what advice would you give to somebody, as somebody who, you know, had mental health issues and you went and you sought help and you're recovering now, what advice would you give to somebody in our community, in the Black community, who's maybe not feeling quite right with themselves?
Speak up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely speak up. Because the reason why we suffer with mental health is because we feel like we haven't got a voice. And you could, if you like try to look at history, you realize if you feel like you haven't got a voice, it will definitely affect you. Mm-hmm. So I'll just say, speak up, speak up and just speak. Because the more you speak is the more help you could get. Because realizing something, no one knows what's going through your head until you speak.
Yeah. It's so nice to actually have you come back and just see how different he
is.
Like even now, like you've got like a glow about you. You're smiling more. Yeah. You're laughing more. Even like your aura, you just seem so much more happier, and that's such a joy to see.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
No, it's really fantastic, and just keep on speaking. And the more that we can help you,
and
others.
Oh no, definitely.
That'd be good.
Yeah, because I think that's kind of what I'm trying to. Hopefully, when I get my stuff sorted out, I'm going to be taking part in like raising awareness with people with mental health, because I feel like a lot of us, because we feel like we haven't got that voice, we suffer in silence, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not good to suffer in silence when the world is that big, man.
Yeah. Exactly.
And with so much people in the world, you know? Yeah. And yet still there's someone that suffers in silence.
And there are people out there who will help
you. Exactly, there are. But if you don't speak, how can they reach you?
Yeah, exactly. Damien, it's such a joy to see you.
Cheers.
And to see you smiling and seeing you happy. We wish you all the best for the future, and thank you for coming in on the Voices of Windrush.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you.
Colourful Sinai and Patrick on Colourful Radio.
Okay, so I've just got Rochelle, who I've met as a result of the scandal, and especially your father, Waldo, who, in many ways, it was because of him I got involved in doing the petition. All that was 15 months ago now, maybe longer.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got Merle, who is a kind of expressive arts healing empowerment facilitator who has worked for many decades in the UK and internationally. Let's start with you first, Rochelle. When you found out, when your dad got that letter from the Home Office, the red letter saying to report and you may be likely to be deported, what was the impact on you?
It was mainly shock initially, because it had been going on for a while that he was trying to prove the fact that he was British, and he already acquired a passport in 1975, I think it was. So, you know, we just thought that it was just, for about 12 or so years, thought it was just kind of them messing up.
Mm.
But seeing it in black and white there was like, wow, it's real, you know. And so it was kind of like stages. So it was like shock, and it was fight or flight. And I think my dad was fighting for a while, but I was fighting.
Mm-hmm.
So then that kicked in for me, and I got quite angry and kind of like need to get stuff done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in many ways, I know that you've always worked in art, and you've combined art around the whole stuff around Windrush, and I've seen your work, and it's fantastic. And
thank you.
I'm a big fan of yours, you know that anyway. But when you said it kicked in, what did it mean for you in terms of your mental well-being? It kicked in. How did it feel for you, and not just you, but your children and your mum?
Yeah, see, for me, I suppose I'm quite aware of my mental health. I suffer from anxiety and depression, and it was heightened by that. I've always had, you know, like the general public will have depression, anxiety. I think we all suffer from it at some points. We have our lows and our highs. But last year, for me, it was almost like I was just, my mind was clouded. I know, it was like a really bizarre, like I wasn't really grounded. that's how much the anxiety took over. For my children, you know, my younger daughter, who's 9 now, she said she was 8 last year, she was quite frightened. But more, you know, and I'm not kind of saying that her feelings are not relevant at all, because they are, but my eldest daughter's autistic, and how it affected her was extremely difficult for us to cope with as a family. She would have nosebleeds, and she would go to school and worry, and the anxiety in her, you know, was really terrible, because she didn't know how to vocalize it effectively to for people to understand what she was going through. My mother health deteriorated as a result, and unfortunately she's very unwell now. I've become, with my father, her carer, as well as working full time. So, you know, it all came out in different ways for all of us. Mm-hmm. You know, my dad kind of played the standoffish, like, staunch man, and did that whole kind of unfortunate stereotype that men find that they need to be like. But there was moments when my dad was really upset, but he didn't allow people to see that. But you find with my dad that the constant repetition and telling the story, you can hear the emotion within him. I think you were there that day when we were at the commission set kits.
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah.
And that was the first time he publicly spoke.
He did. And he sat next to me and cried in that meeting. And I've seen my dad cry maybe once before. So, you know, and that says a lot, actually. That moment where you were present, that says a lot about how it affected us.
Sure. I'll come to your art in a minute. I want to just bring Merlin. Merlin, well, when you've heard about the scandal, what was your initial reaction?
Well, I was absolutely flabbergasted, because I wasn't exactly one of the Windrush, but I was recruited here after. Although I am a creative arts facilitator, my first profession in this country was a nurse. Okay. So I was recruited here to come as a nurse. And I know what I went through during that time as a nurse. And so I had a kind of relationship with that story to some extent. I really couldn't believe it, because I tried to imagine those people being like homeless and stateless, not belonging, no, kicked out of here, but having nowhere to go in the West Indies. And I couldn't imagine what it would be like, maybe like somebody sleeping in the streets. Mm-hmm. So that was the kind of hit it had on me. And I can imagine the anxiety and depression and panic attacks and that sense of not belonging after what they would have gone through to having been invited here to build up this country. That really takes a lot to get your head around, and at that age. Mm-hmm. So there's a multitude of things that came to my mind, you know. After having lived here, helped to build up the country, experienced racism, and then it's like, what else?
Mm-hmm. You would feel used. Like, you took us when we was young. We gave our strength, our good years. We worked so long. We went through so much hardships, and now you're saying we don't want you anymore.
Yes, because in part of my story as a nurse was that what they did when they recruited us here, they told us, your daughter, your child would be a nurse in 2 years' time. And that's very exciting for any mother back in the West Indies. 2 years would be a nurse, great stuff. In reality, when we got here, what we found was that they have got a 2 nursing system here. One is called SEN and one is called SRN. And we were all recruited here to do the SEN training, 2 years, which is not an international certificate. It doesn't go any far. You're really meant to stay here. But that was not explained to our parents. So by the time my SEN training was finished, the head of the teaching department brought me to her office, and she said, "Well, I'd like to have a word with you." She said, "You know, you've done very well. Your grades have been fantastic. I think you can go ahead and do your SRN training." I thought, well, thank you very much, because the hospital had 2 wings, and we, the SCNs, were in the north wing, and the south wing, she was really trying to recruit me to go there. Right. So what I did, I went, I said, "Thank you very much for letting me know. I have been doing so well. And I went and I applied to London hospitals. This hospital was in the Midlands, where I was first. I applied to London hospitals to do my SRN training. I'm going to be good, aren't I? So I came to London. I did my SRN training, right? In 2 years, not three, because of the SCN training, yes? And at the end of the training, the way it works, you have two examinations and two certificates. One is a hospital exam and a hospital badge. One is the other one is a state examination, state badge. And that's the important one. And you get that results first. Qualification, certificate, badge. Now you're waiting for the results of the hospital. Having received our qualifications and the badge and certificates, we're looking at coffee time, you're going to look on the wall to see our results, to see if we passed, right? We all went to the wall in the teaching department. All the white nurses saw their results and went to it, and all the black nurses were going over the list again and again and again, and we couldn't see our names, okay? So we peel ourselves from the wall and we turn around, but on the opposite wall was a very eccentric tutor we had who had obviously seen this many times before. So we turned to him and we said, well, what's going on? He said, meet me at the pub tonight and I'll tell you all what's going on. We went to the pub and he told us, you would not be getting your SRN salary, your SRN belt and badge, and you're going to have to do the exam in 6 months' time again. And I said to him, well, I won't be doing that. I won't be hanging around. I'm giving him my notice now. He said, well, she wouldn't accept your notice. I said, well, I'll cross that bridge when I come to it. So I gave my notice. She accepted it. I was immediately thrown to night duty. Geriatric ward, 25 geriatrics, all in senile dementia. Okay? That's okay, I can do that. About night 5 or 6, I went to the dining room where we always meet at night so the night sister can reallocate us if anybody's sick, yes? I went there and I'm hearing somebody else is going on my ward. Then everybody left and I'm the only person sitting in the dining room. So I said to the night sister, did I come to work on the wrong night? She said, oh no, nurse. Matron is waiting to see you in the office. I go to the office, and to cut a long story short, matron is telling me that one of those 25 geriatric patients, senile dementia, all in cot beds, reported me as having tied a patient's hands to the cot. What? The old bed. I thought to myself, but if you want to lie intelligently. Mm. I said to her, well, I didn't do that. Could you call the junior nurse who was with me last night to come here and tell you I didn't do that? Oh, no, nurse, we never call juniors to give evidence among seniors. I felt the rope tie around my neck. I said, well, matron, that's when I'll be saying goodbye to you and thank you very much for the training. And I walk out. I went to the room. I called my partner, said, come over here with the suitcase and get me now. And when the tutor told us about the that she wouldn't take notice and everything, he said, and also she wouldn't be giving you a reference. He said, but don't worry, I'll give you a reference. So I went back a few days later, and to get the references from him and give him a gift, and I was gone. First job, St. Thomas's Hospital, Teaching Hospital, St. George's Hospital, Great Ormond Street. That matron is gone bad. So basically, I was one of the only ones who left, the others stayed. So basically what I realized that they wanted us as slaves, in my judgment, you know, to continue working, and you've got a qualification, you've got the international certificate, the international badge, but you can stay there and work not as an SRN.
Well, it's interesting that you just shared that whole story. But in terms of your work as a therapist, can you just, from your perspective, what do you think is the impact of the scandal on the black community or people in the, what, from the work that you've done for many, you've worked internationally and,
yeah. Okay, so what it is, let us look at creativity as healing, because I work across the arts. I work with the creative process, yes? So let's share with you how creativity works, right? Creativity is the deepest level of who we are, and it plays a central role in our health and well-being. It holds our life, the truth, and freedom to be, bringing clarity and understanding, and enriches the soul. When we have emotions which we cannot find words for, or when we feel overwhelmed by the emotions, so we are scared to express it, using a creative expression allows you to find another language to express those emotions, and you are expressing it from you, from your you. Yes. Also, the body, our body is our temple, and the body stores the history and all your stories. So you really need to go back into the body and process. If you don't go in and process, the trauma remains in the body as emotional and psychological scars, and they remain there until you process them out. So so my work is to encourage people to go, what I call, go backwards to go forwards, go back inside and sit, turn off the noise, and use the tools that I share with them to process the unfinished business, to unpack the baggage. And for example, if you have an image, once you put it in drawing and you see it, you get such clarity. You begin to see, to find answers to the question, why? And find another way to move on. And this is what drawing does. And in terms of, like when I use dance, because everything goes into the body, often the body is contracted. Mm-hmm. With tension, yes, with the body, by working with the body, by working with dance, you release the body and you release all the stresses in the body. And in terms of theater, I use something called forum theater. They also see, you sit back and you see your story being played out, and you see alternative ways that you can change your story and to change the outcome, rather than being stuck just playing it over and over and over and over. Or I encourage people to do creative writing. Write it. It's all about putting it out of the head so you stop the spinning.
This is so interesting.
Yeah, and of course, we use massage. Massage is essential because the stuff is trapped in the body. And so with massage, you're beginning to release it. And when you release it, I've had clients, the massage, and their eyes close and they get in the massage and they wake up and they get a bit of paper and they start drawing, because you start to, you touch the trauma, because we put the trauma somewhere in the body. So if, like I was saying earlier on, if you're living in Hampstead and you had a traumatic experience and you moved to Belfast, you've just carried the stuff with you, you haven't done anything. So relocating and moving doesn't get rid of the psychological and emotional scars that's in the body, and the psychosomatic illnesses which will come thereafter if you haven't dealt with the body. And if you look at during the apartheid times, the South African people used the gumboot dance. That gumboot dance was a codified dance, and they used that to talk to each other, because they were not allowed to have conversations. Yes, so they got group support. Through the language, talking through the gumboot dance. And you look at carnival is the same thing. Carnival is about that release once a year, that big release once a year, and it's again in the body.
We don't realize these things, yeah, like how therapeutic they are. Every time I go to carnival, I come out feeling like a different person. I feel lighter, like I've just released all the stress. I've left it on the floor. Labrick Grove, and I'm going home a new person. Exactly. Now, I want to bring in Rachelle. Is this art therapy as well? Is something that you think works as well?
I think it can do. I don't practice art therapy, nor have I experienced it per se. But as an artist, I do tend to use things that I've experienced and portray it in my work. It's my form of communication. So I've done a piece based on what happened with my father and the trauma I experienced, feeling not British anymore because the government basically told us that. But yeah, generally in terms of all my bodies of work, it's been about things that I've struggled with or had put upon me, and I've used the creative process to kind of release that. And, you know, I work with mental health in various provisions over the past few years, and myself, so I understand the importance of communication, and I find that it's just another way to kind of talk, and talking is important.
Yeah, let me bring in Patrick.
Do you want to talk about the artwork that you did?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell us about it.
Okay. Yes. So basically, I was asked to come and do a speech at Diana Abbott's event at Parliament, where I think Patrick was chair.
I chaired the event, yeah.
Yeah, you did chair the event.
Yeah.
And at that time, I hated public speaking. I still don't particularly like it, but I don't hate it anymore. And I had to read something. So my dad did something, and I wrote something that people kind of interpreted as a sort of poem. So what I did with that poem, I wanted to share it further, share what my experience and what I went through to kind of engage other people with what was happening. In the best way I know how to communicate, so that was done through my art. So I, at the time I was still working at Childline, so I would go on my shift and in between shifts and everywhere else, and I would stitch this speech. Because the main medium I use is embroidery and cross-stitching using Ada and stuff. So I stitched my speech in the shape of London, and it was Enoch Powell's 50th anniversary of the Rivers of Blood speech last year. So I incorporated doing the Thames in red with words coming out towards the end. And it was, for me, it was part of the processing of what I experienced, because at the time talking about it didn't help because I was so anxious about talking about it in front of hundreds of people. So I kind of took the negativity that I was storing and kind of spilled it out onto something I felt that came out quite positively.
Well, I think it's a brilliant piece of work.
Thank you.
Even hearing you describe it, I really want to see it now, because the idea that the Thames is red and there's these words, I'm like, it sounds amazing.
Well, yeah, it's, I'm really arrogant there. That wasn't the case. I was going to say, I'm exhibiting it for a pop-up today.
Okay.
In Stoke Newington, but it's been bouncing around and...
It's online.
Where is it online? Where can the listeners see it?
It's on my website. So that's rachelromeoart.co.uk, and also my Instagram on Rachel Romeo Artist. But also Dr. Shah features it on her social performer website, where the guys at RT Underground recorded me and the piece and recorded me saying it. Mm-hmm. So it's like a different view of exhibiting it as well. Okay. So have a look.
Yeah,
Google me.
We will do. Fantastic.
I want to ask Merle, so in terms of, we've been here and having a conversation about the whole issue around Windrush and different therapeutic interventions. How would it work in doing what you were describing in terms of having this, could you have a large scale art therapy and intervention using all forms of art forms? You know, like people can come to the Africa Centre and would they try out some writing, try out some, have a massage. Do you think that if that was made available, do you think people would be interested in that? In terms of that, or is it more about having an educational conversation first?
No. It's not. It's not about having an educational conversation first. Because in actual fact, the work you gain the tools. It's in the doing. It isn't about having a lecture. I don't normally give a lecture. So it's about me inviting them to move, draw, sing, dance. So you gain the ability to use the tools from doing. So so yes, if people would be interested in exploring the power of their creativity, we can do that. As I said, singing, dancing, drawing, moving, and not massage necessarily, taking off clothes, because they could massage each other. You know, there are different masters I can give them to do with their clothes on. But there's something else I wanted to share with you, Leon, as we were talking about after I left the hospital. What I realized in my years later on, I'm also a photographer, right? And I love traveling. Traveling is my passion. When I reflect back, I realize that if I didn't listen to my inner voice, my inner woman, right, I would have stayed there. Yes? Mm. And those are some of the things I like to pick out and share to show how I end up doing this type of work later on. And as I've done this work and I experienced the power of this work, I realize how much I could have never been here had I stayed there and had my whole spirit crushed completely as a slave. Do you see what I'm saying? Yeah. So it's about showing in my work, I help people to understand by going backwards to go forward, you listen to your wise woman on the inside. Mm-hmm. And listen to the wise woman, that is, and the wise person inside. That's also what artists are doing. People who are artists, and you see the type of work they paint. I think of this English guy, what is his name? Okay, I can't remember. Who paint, and his painting is very much about entrapment. So you can tell that their story was about, often they've had a childhood or some experiences in their life earlier on where they felt entrapped, and they put it out. And by putting it out, you release, you see? You release and you become free, you see? So that is what I realized. Had I stayed, I would never have been able to do my photography and travel and see the world. I traveled for 1 year around the world with a backpack, going to many, many different countries, you see? And then I do things like this. And I'm now able to share it with people around the world, that you can heal yourself, you can empower yourself. It's all in there, but people don't know that.
That's the message then.
Yes, with no drugs.
Yeah.
With no drugs.
I would love to have you like come to the Africa Center, and we'll do like some workshops with you or something like that, where we can invite people in to try out some of these therapies. Like I feel like we need this in our community. It's similar to what we were talking to with Malcolm and
David
about us basically healing ourselves and helping ourselves as a community. We cannot rely solely on the NHS when they can't really cater to every single one of our needs.
I totally agree with you. I was just, if you think of the history of slavery, you know, I feel there's a way to look at that history and look and see the impact it has had on us and begin to see what we need to do. Mm-hmm. Because we have internalized a lot of stuff from that experience, which has a lot to do with abuse, abandonment, and a lot of negative experience. And that is being dragged along still today. But like I was saying to Rochelle earlier on, you know, it's so easy to come home and talk about the abuse and talk about it next week and last week and the week after and talk about the abusive experiences. My work is primarily over here to prevent. I share that at Black Culture Lager. Prevent, right? Then there's a trauma, and then there's after the trauma. And what I see is a lot of emphasis for our community after the damage has been done. Look at those black kids on the street with knives. No black history, no black role models, you know, no black strong black identity. You know, people who are writing plays, they don't write in black solicitors, black doctors, black lawyers, no, it's a black doorman or a black porter or a black, you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And no black history. I don't know if it's changed now, but I certainly didn't get black history in the West Indies. I know all about Mary, Queen of Scots, and Henry VIII, and Catherine of Aragon. That's what I got sitting in the sun. You see? So I don't know me, and they don't know me, so I don't exist. Do you see what I'm saying? Yeah. So you don't exist. So why bother about if I get shot tomorrow? I mean, I don't exist. I'm not here. And this is the impact it can have on people. Mm-hmm. You see, so it's plus the other stuff from slavery, which has been internalized and carried on in terms of the stories. But we need stories about empowerment, how to empower yourself,
yeah,
how to get the tools to empower yourself to be able to say, "You stop there."
Mm-hmm. I want to ask Rochelle, because you've been involved in campaigning. You're a reluctant campaigner, but you've been involved in campaigning. What do you think needs to happen next for justice for the Windrush generation?
I think, you know, what's happening next now, I think, you know, they've put out the compensation scheme, and I know people have their different kind of views on it and whatnot. So I think it's about us coming together as a community and being more open-eyed about what's going on. I'm finding a lot of people still struggling to kind of, in those roles that have been given in the narratives, like, you know, still blaming one another. And I think we need to kind of actually, this is what's happening and it could happen to you. Mm. I think, you know, listening to
Mel,
sorry, you know, and listening to, because I was speaking to her outside about the toolbox and about prevention. And, you know, I think in terms of what I can think of in terms of the Windrush scandal and what happened, a lot of the people affected by it were kind of at a standstill and didn't know what to do, and their children, like myself and I think a few others, I don't want to mention them in case I weren't fully correct, they fought for them. So it was that kind of thing of the younger generation stepping up. And I think that's really important now, to get younger people to actually be aware and not treat it like a passing fad. Mm-hmm. And it, for it to be real, if people can be going on Twitter, sitting there going on for 2 months about Love Island, why they don't find it that important to talk about what could happen to them in 10 years' time.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we're in a situation where you've got all these influencers talking about various trivial materialistic things, but these influencers don't realise they could be put on an aeroplane in 10 years' time.
Yeah. Mm.
So I think it's about kind of campaigning that awareness forever and empowering ourselves as a community to be able to recognise our strengths and, you know, looking, not allowing people to put their own stigmas upon us, mm-hmm. and actually working towards building up a proper insight to what we're about and what we are, and that is human and that have rights. You know, it's about being human, you know, having that humanitarian kind of approach, but also enabling people to actually recognise us for who we are, not what they perceive us to be.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I feel that there are a lot of distractions out there, especially on social media. You'll see things trending that don't necessarily affect us, but we're all talking about it. And I feel like I'm like, you've got 50,000 people following you. Why are you talking about something that's so far away when there's issues that are happening right here, right now, that affect our community, but they're not vocal about it? And that's quite upsetting.
Definitely. I think, you know, especially as being a Black British person and, you know, growing up in the 90s, being born in the 80s, growing up in the 90s and being kind of bombarded with American culture and Black American, like British people, Black people didn't have any culture, and being taught about transatlantic slavery and not talk about what British people did in this, with the slave trade and the buildings that in this country and companies such as Barclays and so forth that were funded through slavery. I think, you know, that's quite disappointing. You know, that was a major thing for my mental health actually that was affected, was my friends that were Black and white had no idea about the fact that I could be seen as not being British.
Mm.
And I think education is key in that sense. And I think, you know, I did a march with the Advocacy Academy regarding that too. And it was young people kind of pushing for that recognition of Black British history and migrant history should be taught in British schools.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's been absolutely fascinating having you both in. We would have to leave it there because we have run out of time, but it has been great speaking to you both about art, about the Windrush generation, and of course how we can help heal ourselves.
And when you think about it, that our people are body orientated anyway, are you with me? We already have a tool that we just have to kind of connect it with, use it to heal and show them how they can use it. Like we bring the drawing in, you see the image, close your eyes, you see the image, dance the image out, for example. That is part of how I work, but you know, because the image is right there, the image of the shock is right there. Close it, see it, visualize it, open your eyes, draw it, dance it, liberate yourself. But they need somebody to guide them, to facilitate a voice in the background to make the connection between the power of the body and releasing the trauma.
Yeah.
And that is what I do.
And before we go, Mel, where can people get in touch with you online? Do you have a website?
I do. www.rehearsalforchange.com.
Okay, and one more time for you, Rochelle, where can people reach you online to see your art?
On my Instagram is probably the best one, which is Rochelle Romeo Artist. I also have a website, rochelleromeoart.co.uk.
Thank you so much. You have been listening to The Voices of Windrush with me, Sinai Flary, and my fantastic co-host,
Patrick Vernon.
Colourful
Sinai and Patrick on Colourful Radio.